But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to The Advice Show. I'm reporter Alicia Hagopian, and I'm joined by Becky O'Connor, Director of Public Affairs for Pension B. Hi, Becky. How's it going?
Oh, good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. So today we're going to be discussing WASPI women and the recent changes that have been made around that. And I wonder if you could explain, Becky, before we begin, a bit of your background and what Pension B does.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Director of Public Affairs at Pension B. As you mentioned, I've been there for a year. Pension B is an online pension platform. It's a consolidated platform. And mostly my work involves press and public affairs and commentary on the very many issues around pensions, particularly pensions policy that the industry deals with and that pension savers deal with. Before that, I was head of pensions at Interactive Investor, doing a very, very similar job, but for a platform that also sells ISAs and so on. And before that, I was personal finance specialist at Royal London, the very large mutual insurance company, again, doing lots of media commentary on issues that consumers face with financial services in general. My background before that is journalism, though. So I was personal finance and business reporter at The Times for many years, and then a freelance journalist. And I also co-founded a website called Good With Money, which is about sustainable personal finance, which was very niche at the time we founded it, but has since grown happily into a bigger area. So, yeah, I've touched on a few different aspects of pensions, investing, long-term saving in the 20 plus years that I've been in the industry.
So onto the topic of WASPI women. The reason that we're discussing this today is that a pensions ombudsman report came out suggesting that WASPI women are owed billions in compensation. So could you explain that situation from the start to finish, and also explain, I mean, just to start, what does WASPI mean?
So WASPI stands for Women Against State Pension Inequality. And it was a campaign group that was set up to highlight the issue caused by the increase in the state pension age for women from age 60 to 65. So from 1948 to 2010, the state pension entitlement age was 60 for women. It increased for men sooner than it did for women. But there was several issues that the campaign group wanted to highlight about the way that increase was implemented and communicated that they felt was very unfair, because many of them weren't able to save into private pensions to compensate for the loss of state pension income that they had been expecting their whole lives to start from age 60 and not age 65. So the actual increase from 60 to 65 happened gradually. It affected millions of women. However, there was a group of women within those millions of women who felt that it had affected them particularly badly for various reasons, legitimate reasons, I have to say. I think that the issue is it's kind of often misunderstood as a kind of complaint that the state pension age rose at all. And there might have been an element of that at some point along the way. But I think it's not so much that the state pension age rose to equal men's state pension age that has become the primary complaint. It's that it wasn't done in a fair and proper way. And this issue has, as a result of the campaign group's efforts, been investigated in depth for several years now, in particular by the Parliamentary Health and Social Ombudsman. And they have been looking into it for more than 5 years. They've done several reports now. This was the final report that we had just over a week ago. And they did find some failings in the way the Department for Work and Pensions communicated the changes to women at the time, or over time. There were some things they did say the DWP had got right. For instance, a sort of quite loud campaign in the news media at the time, the sending of leaflets and so on. But there were some specific failings in communication that the PHSO said had left women with a diminished sense of financial control and inability to plan their finances accordingly. And they said there was a failure to give accurate, adequate and timely advice, and that there should be an apology and compensation to women. The findings have proved very divisive, it seems, and now there is a group of people who feel quite strongly that the campaign group and the women affected should not get compensation because they should have paid more attention for themselves. It was their, you know, it was their job to make sure they knew when the state pension age change was coming in and to plan accordingly, and that there was enough notice and everyone knew, so why didn't you? And it's your own fault. And then the alternative view, which has come out quite strongly in the Ombudsman report itself, which is that there was, even though there was some campaigning and even though there was awareness, there was a gap between that awareness of the change coming in and an understanding of how it would affect individuals specifically. And it's this gap between the awareness and understanding that many women fell into, and has to be said, have you know, many have suffered real hardship as a result. And clearly, you know, that consequence will have depended on other life circumstances to some extent as well. But I think it's become a really interesting debate, a very charged debate, and one that is quite gendered as well, I have to say. And I'm very, very interested to see what the government does as a result.
Yeah, so that's really fascinating and a really great description. Thank you for being so thorough. I mean, there's so many sort of spin-off questions that I have from this. And as you mentioned, it is quite polarizing, perhaps even surprisingly so, and it is quite gendered. And I want to touch on those things in a minute. But if we go back to what the report found, you know, as you said, the DWP were found to have done some things right, but there were some specific failures in communication and maybe some feelings, certainly among the WASP group, that it was not publicized to an adequate degree. So we're talking about a state pension change, which increased the age in which women would receive their pension, right? So I suppose, how could they have communicated that better? And in what ways were they found to have failed?
So the main point of failure that the issue of compensation rests upon is around 2005. So the DWP had conducted surveys in 2004 where it found that there was a lack of understanding of the consequences of the change for individuals, but it didn't act on the findings of that survey by sending letters to individuals who would be affected by the change, explaining clearly how they would be affected and what they would have to do. So 2005 was a temporal point of failure. And it was this lack of communication around this time and failure to act on information from the surveys that showed people weren't really understanding the implications for themselves that was the focus of the Ombudsman findings. So it did, you know, it did find that there was good communication prior to that. However, you know, the campaign group and women have said, well, you know, there may have been that, but I didn't read the news. I didn't really watch TV. I didn't really listen to the radio. And so that the question mark then is whether or not anyone would consider that a reasonable excuse for not knowing about it. And the ombudsman feels that it actually, you know, it is a decent reason. And one thing the DWP could and should have done to overcome that would have been to send individual letters at that point in time, which it didn't do.
So do you think that when you're talking about a sort of gap of between knowledge and understanding, do you think that, for example, women would have seen that the state pension age was increasing, but thought, oh, well, that will be bad for some people, just not me, because my state pension age is still 60. Is it that sort of thing?
Yes, I think so. I think, you know, now women's lives can be incredibly busy running households day to day, often on top of work, thinking often not about themselves, but about their children. Particularly, you know, for this particular generation of women who were born in the 1950s, you can, I suppose, describe them as a transitional generation from a cohort that were very dependent on their husbands, often didn't work themselves, relied on husbands for pensions, and they tended to look after the home. And maybe they did have a job, but maybe it was part-time. They perhaps weren't as able to build up their own private pension provision to, you know, a decent enough degree to compensate for not having the state pension. And, you know, we still have a situation where women are, generally speaking, the carers, the child carers, and, you know, carers for older relatives and so on throughout life. But I think these women, they grew up expecting that they would receive the state pension at 60 because it had always been that way, as far as they were aware. I mean, it hasn't, but as far as they were aware, it had been. And so they had that sort of basic understanding and perhaps didn't really think that they ever needed to think about it again, because that's just the way things were. And that's the way their whole lives had been geared up. And there were still many of them not working full-time, not saving into a private pension, and not really taking full responsibility for their own private pension savings. Now, we live in a different world now, so it's quite hard, I think, to understand that, you know, genuine sense of lack of financial responsibility for oneself. But it was a different time. And I think, you know, there's some women within those millions in that group who were born in the 1950s who did work and did take financial responsibility for themselves, but it's not a homogenous group. And I think we do need to understand that it's, you know, culturally a bit of a transition group.
Well, you know, I think that's a good point. And obviously, I mean, you and me and people listening to this podcast probably have a high degree of financial literacy, but that is not everyone, as we know. I think that, you know, as we were talking about, there is a huge gendered element to this, and it's a lot more complicated than just sort of men versus women, because I've also seen online there are a lot of women who were affected by the state pension increases who are angry at the WASPI group for trying to receive compensation, because they said, you know, I know better, why didn't you know better? So I think I was wondering what you think about that, and about that feeling that, you know, if one person was fine, surely everyone should have been fine.
I mean, I think quite honestly, you know, there's a lack of compassion. I think just because I know loads about money doesn't mean I expect everyone to know about it. And just because I'm somebody who takes responsibility doesn't mean that I think is, you know, the case for everybody that they, you know, that they must and that they can. I mean, yeah, clearly it would be great if we had more financial education earlier on and people understood the degree of personal responsibility that we have for our own finances now. But I also understand the circumstances in which that doesn't always happen for people, because they are, you know, more focused on the day-to-day management of the household, children, other people, all the other things that get in the way. And, you know, perhaps they did have a husband who liked taking on more of the long-term financial management of the household. And we know that there are there is research that shows that men do tend to take more responsibility for that side of the domestic finances, and women do tend to take more responsibility for the day-to-day, you know, budgeting, spending, and so on. Rightly or wrongly, this is how people often balance those different responsibilities. So, I mean, in terms of the, you know, well, I knew, so you should have, I just think we're all different with different circumstances. In terms of this discussion around, well, you know, of course, women's state pension age should equal that of men. I agree, you know, we do want to be equal. And there are some things that come with that equality and shift to equality that women have to accept. The difficult thing about it for me is that we still don't have gender pay equality, and we don't have gender pension equality. And the reasons we don't have those things is because women do still take more time out of work to care, and that hasn't changed. There are various reasons why it hasn't changed, but a big one is to do with paternity pay for parental leave not, generally speaking, being equal to maternity pay. So it almost always makes sense for a woman to take more time out when a couple starts a family, because she will be paid more to do so than her husband. And that's kind of where it all goes wrong, and means that, you know, women don't get back to work as quickly as men, and, you know, because of that financial penalty, they have another child, the same thing happens. They maybe go back to work part-time, they maybe go back to work full-time, but then, you know, it takes a few years to get to that point, pay for childcare and so on. So the equality of the state pension age was partly predicated on an understanding that there were more women in the workplace and women were more equal to men in the workplace in general, and that that would continue to improve over the years. That hasn't actually happened. So while I'm not saying that women's state pension age should go back to 60, we are where we are. There are several things that we still need to address. And we have got equality of the state pension age, but not equality elsewhere. So it's not really come to pass in the way that I think the government thought it would when they set the timescales for the transition to 65.
If you're just thinking about it, you know, we've had since then, we've had some state pension age changes, right? But it's, you know, increasing by a year or two each time. It's not increasing by a substantial amount. And probably a large reason why the WSP group was so heavily affected was because it was a 5-year chunk change. And that is much harder to plan for sort of last minute than a 1-year change if you're approaching that. But the thing is, as you're describing, we're living longer. We have millions of more people who are at that state pension age now. So if we're going to be continuing to increase the state pension age, it is actually foreseeable that they could start to increase the state pension age by more than a year or two at a time. You could be seeing another 5-year. You know, I'm not saying that this is the case, where you could even see a 10-year increase in the state pension age. And so the WSP situation might not be a sort of one-off situation that they were terribly affected. It could actually be the start of other groups being affected who may have taken the state pension age for granted. So I wonder if you sort of think that based on that, whether they will pay that compensation.
I think they should pay that compensation. Whether they will or not, I think would depend on whether they can set fair parameters for who should receive it from that cohort of women. Because, as I said, you know, and as you pointed out, not everybody within that age group who is affected feels like they were hard done by. Many feel exactly the opposite and feel very strongly that, you know, those other women who have been campaigning shouldn't get the compensation. But I think some of them should. And I think it is up to the government to identify those who were affected and need compensation. And, you know, it's not much compensation, is it, on an individual level? I know collectively it is. But when you think about how much state pension income they have actually missed out on, it's nothing. It's a drop in the ocean. So I think that, you know, in terms of setting those parameters, they would be looking at who had to take time out to care, who wouldn't have been able to retrain easily because of caring responsibilities, who, you know, had too much other stuff in their lives. Maybe they, you know, they were divorced and their husband got the pension that, you know, was his pension. But, you know, if they'd done a pension sharing order, they would have had some of it, but that didn't happen. I realise that would be very difficult for the government to look into individual circumstances like that. But I think some sort of clear criteria which demonstrates that the government is aware that some people would just not have been able to make that up for themselves. So, I mean, if you were to replace 5 years of state pension now, you know, you'd be looking at additional private pension saving of around £60,000. That does not happen easily. You know, even on an average salary, it would take several years to build up that, you know, a decade at least, to build up that level of additional private pension savings. And to expect that women, you know, who had dependents, who had lots of other responsibilities, who hadn't necessarily been in the workforce for a while, to have just dropped everything and gone back to work for 15 years to make up their private pension shortfall to compensate for the increase in the state pension age is completely unrealistic. Some women would have been able to do that. Some were working anyway, so it didn't affect them. Some continued to work and continue to work, in fact, past their state pension age. Fine. My mother-in-law is one of those women. She's like, oh, you know, it's just not really affected me. Like, I just knew it was happening and I knew it would affect me and I was working anyway and it's fine. So I think isolating who really needs that compensation is going to be quite important.
I think, you know, what this also brings to mind, if you're saying, you know, £60,000 extra, that's something you have to save up over quite a few years, I would say. Where does sort of financial advice fall into this? Because I imagine that a lot of these women would have benefited from a financial advisor, but a lot of them also wouldn't be able to afford it. So what sort of resources do you think are available for people out there now who might face similar issues?
There are lots of online calculators now which enable you to see how much you need to contribute to reach a certain living standard in retirement. I think the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association Retirement Living Standards is an incredibly useful guide. Sometimes it's quite hard to work back from that annual income to the pot size that you would need to generate that annual income. But I think, you know, that the earlier you start financial planning for yourself, and, you know, despite everything I said, I do really believe, you know, a very good policy for your own long-term financial planning is to basically trust no one but yourself and start planning as early as possible. And we can't go back in time for these women, but, you know, maybe if they had been able to get some guidance online or been able to access some tools, they would have seen what a difference it would have made if they'd, you know, if they had been able to start working sooner again. I mean, they didn't have perfect knowledge, did they? And there wasn't the plethora of tools available then as there is now online to try and help people.
Well, I think that's a really good point about the sort of abilities and tools that we have now that make everything so much sort of, your financial future is sort of in your hands a little bit more than it would have been. And I also think that, to the point of whether the government should have communicated a little bit better with the with pensioners, it's just so much easier to communicate now. It would have been so much easier to notify people. And I would hope that, you know, with future state pension increases, that some of those tools, whether that's, you know, more media or advertising or whatever it is, will be utilized to sort of inform the public a bit better. But one last thing that I want to touch on before we go is, you've talked about the gender pension gap, and you've talked about that in terms of sort of an older generation, but obviously it's still an issue with the current generation and probably still in my generation. Could you talk a bit more about that and whether you think that there's anything, any steps that the government could actually do to step in, or that private companies could do to step in and fill that gap? Or do you think it's just going to always be that way?
There is something that can be done. I would love to see legislation on this particular point. So when we had the coalition government, we had the introduction of shared parental leave for the first year of a child's life. Great, great step forward, really positive. But what didn't happen was any legislation on additional paternity pay from employers having to be equal to the maternity pay on offer to new mothers by those same employers. Now, I'm not an expert in employment law, or, you know, how this would be done from a policy point of view. But as long as you have a situation where men only get like 2 weeks of full pay when they have a baby, and women get more like 6 months of full pay, you are going to have a situation where women take more time out of work because they have to, because the economics of the household just won't support the man taking more time off and not bringing in an income for months. So even though they technically can share the leave, they can't economically. So I think we need to see equal paternity and maternity pay really soon. And I think that would have to be legislated for, because employers wouldn't do it otherwise. Some employers do, by the way. It is improving, but it is, whether or not you benefit as an individual very much will depend on your employer and whether they offer the same to new mothers as to new fathers. And is very hit and miss, and I think most don't still. That would significantly improve the gender pension gap. It wouldn't close it, because you'd still often find that women want to spend more time at home with kids when they have kids. But it would certainly create a situation where there is actual proper equal choice at that point in people's lives. And it would result in some behaviour changes. I mean, I do know dads who have taken advantage of that paternity pay when it's been on offer by the employer, and they have basically properly shared parental leave in that first year. And it's been game changing for their partner's career and ability to keep building a pension and, you know, keep moving up the ladder. To me, it's a complete no-brainer, and it would make a huge difference. But there has been no noise around that happening, as far as I can tell, from anybody in government. So perhaps we need a little campaign there. It's the single biggest thing I can think of that would help. And obviously, you wouldn't see the figures on the gender pension gap, which is 35% now, change overnight. It would take several years, but I would expect it would help a lot.
As you said, you know, the women maybe prefer to spend a bit more time at home with the kids after, but I'm sure that many women do, and I'm also sure that many women feel that they can't afford the costs of childcare, let's say, for two or three children, or even not just afford, but afford good quality, or feel like they can trust to leave their children. So women are just taking more time off work anyway. And it's not really just a maternity leave thing. It's not just about when you've given birth. It's that whole sort of system around that doesn't add up. And the way that it often is that the woman takes the time and not the man. So, you know, that leave and that gap in the pension can start to be about a few years, you know, until your children are 5 years old or something like that. So that really, really grows. And one last thing I wanted to ask is, for people who are approaching their pension age, or they're looking to sort of tie everything together, is there any advice that you have, or any resources. I know that PensionBee offers, you know, quite a few resources on this. So if there's any tips you have for anyone.
We do have several tools and calculators on the PensionBee website. We were talking about this earlier, but we have a state pension gap calculator where you can work out how much extra you would need in your pension pot to retire before you get the state pension, which is really useful. If you know, we know that the ideal retirement age is still 60, even if very few people are actually able to retire that early now, you know, on the basis of the private pension savings they have. So, and the calculators are just, you know, you can play around with the figures. So it can be quite interesting just to see, you know, how much extra pension you could have if you just put an additional £100 a month in, and quite, you know, motivating as well, I would say. So, I mean, as early as possible, start having a play around with the calculators. From 50, you can speak to PensionWise, the government's free service, which is incredibly useful. I mean, from 50 onwards, I think you really need to start thinking about your pension closely, maybe consolidating if you think that's going to help you feel more organized. We recently did some research onto the into the value of lost pots, and with the CEBR, and the figure was 50 billion is at risk of being lost in pensions at the moment. And if you've had a few jobs in the past, even if you didn't work there for very long, you may have had a pension from that employment. So seeing if you can gather old pensions from old employments that you may have long since left behind is a useful thing to do, because that can add up to quite a lot, even if you think that they were quite small pensions at the time.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Becky. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to The Advice Show with myself, Alicia Hagopian, and today we were joined by Becky O'Connor from PensionBee. For any questions, please feel free to tweet us at New Model Advisor or email us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
But today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the bell.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.